World War II not only claimed millions of lives, but it also was responsible for the displacement and dislocation of many, many millions more. Bearing witness to horrible events and going through the process of rebuilding a life are just two of the themes explored in Gita Schwartz's debut novel called Displaced Persons, which follows four Polish Jews as they try to navigate life in the immediate aftermath of the war right up until the turn of the last millennium. It's published by William Morrow, and I'm very pleased that it brings Ms. Schwartz to our show today. Hello.
Hello. I'm thrilled to be here, Leonard.
You open your novel in 1945, and right after the war is over, we meet Pavel, Fila, and Chaim. What are their backstories?
Well, Pavel, all of them were born in Poland, and none of them know each other prior to meeting each other right after the liberation. And Pavel has just escaped and been liberated from an area near a concentration camp. He sort of wanders into this area near Bergen-Belsen Displaced Persons Camp, which was operated by the British Occupation Authority, and sort of trying to find people that he knew because he hears that this big assembly center is being set up for refugees. And he meets this young woman, Fela, and she survived by fleeing to Russia, to the Soviet Union in the early part of the war. And she has sort of hooked up with this young man, a kid really, about 14 years old, who survived by disguising himself as a Gentile throughout the war. And together they sort of make a home together and try to figure out what to do next and how to find relatives.
And that kind of represents the different ways that people did survive during the Holocaust. Were the refugee camps all that different from the concentration camps they were replacing?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think
were there attempts to make them at least a little hospitable? Because people are going, in many cases, are going from a camp to a camp.
That's right. Well, the camps operated for several years. So, of course, by the end of the displaced persons era, they were much more comfortable and had this sort of very developed culture. At the very beginning, you know, people were still starving and didn't really know how to eat properly. And, you know, there were all these huge medical issues that the British authorities and the American authorities were sort of encountering and trying to rescue people. But after a fairly short time, this incredibly developed society sprung up with schools, newspapers so people could try to find relatives, theaters. I mean, really an incredible mini culture of Eastern European Jews.
Were there also French and Russian refugee camps?
There were some refugee camps scattered all over Europe. There were some in Italy. The Russians operated their own sort of system that everybody's sort of trying to flee. Everybody's goal was to get to the British and American zones, in part because it was easier to emigrate to Britain and the United States when you were within their jurisdiction.
Now, Pavel is the youngest of the three, but he also seems to be wise beyond his years. And they don't want to stay in the refugee camps.
No, I mean, actually what they do is they sort of find this house that is occupied by a German woman and sort of repossess it, which a lot of Jews did at that time.
It had been owned by Jews before the war?
That's exactly right, but not by them. And those people are apparently not really coming back. So they sort of install themselves in the British zone, but sort of right outside the camps, and that's a much better place to live. And there are some characters that sort of come in a little bit later into the book who are living within the displaced persons camp, and their accommodations are just, you know, much more difficult.
How much of their thinking was day-to-day? Were they able to I'm talking to you now not about your characters, but your characters are based on real people and real situations. Were they able to imagine a future, or were they just thinking about, well, I've just survived one of the most terrible things in history, and I want to get through today, and then maybe tomorrow I want to get through tomorrow.
Well, I think, you know, things change over time. Right after people were liberated, especially when they were liberated directly from camps, you know, many of them were hungry. They didn't have clothes. I mean, there are sort of certain things they needed to set up for themselves before they could even look for relatives in any sort of competent or organized manner. And then there are other characters who are, you know, were very deprived during the war but aren't, you know, quite as limited and are, you know, getting on the track of trying to find their relatives really soon. But as the time passes in the displaced persons camps, people really start to think not just about how to survive, but sort of how to represent what they've gone through to the whole world and to themselves and to their children.
What about that designation, displaced person? Is that something you can ever really get away from? Would you always feel a bit displaced even if you start a new family or go to a new country?
Well, I think that's the case for any immigrant, that there's always this sense of displacement, and it's not always a bad thing. At the time, in these displaced persons camps, it was a somewhat pejorative term. I mean, it was an official term, but, you know, being thought of as a DP was not a positive thing. But, yes, I wanted that title to sort of get across that it's not just about being in a camp called a displaced persons camp right after you're liberated, but also the sort of sense of exile that kind of follows you for the rest of your life.
Well, the word survivor is often used to describe people who survived the concentration camps. But even when they were freed from the camps, many of them still had a long road ahead of them and a lot more to survive. And I remember a friend who told me about her mother who would run across the street when the light changed. And she'd say, "Mom, it's okay. There's enough time to walk." And her mother would say, "Well, the Nazis didn't kill me, and no American car is going to kill me."
That's quite a familiar anecdote to me. Not that exact thing, but yeah. I mean, my dad has a similar background to some of the characters in the novel, and he really didn't care about safety on the road when he was driving. He just figured, you know, Hitler didn't kill him, and no one else is going to either, you know.
My guest is Geeta Schwartz, whose novel, Displaced Persons, is published by William Morrow. Eventually, Pavel Felichayim and his wife, Sima, wind up in the United States. Were DPs faced with a choice, go get to the United States or try to get into the United States or try to get into Palestine?
Well, for most people, it wasn't a huge choice. There were incredible immigration restrictions on Jews. There was enormous debate occurring in the United States over the refugee problem, and there was a lot of fear that the country would be overtaken by Jews.
Well, there had been an earlier immigration policies that had kept many Jews who were trying to escape the Holocaust from getting into the U.S. during the years that the Nazis were in power. Those immigration policies remained in place?
Well, what happened was after the war ended and sort of the world became aware of this massive refugee problem in Europe, a lot of pressure started emerging in places like the United States and Australia and in Britain, because, you know, Britain was in control of Palestine at the time, to sort of liberalize their immigration policies. And what happened in the United States was that when they first started passing these new acts to accommodate the displaced persons, they were set up so that they favored people who were not Jewish. They had sort of like restrictions on whether you came from an agricultural background or whether you made it into a displaced persons camp before such and such date, which a lot of Jews couldn't do. And eventually the Displaced Persons Act was liberalized by President Truman. But it was really, you know, an amazing political moment that we don't remember at all today.
Well, a lot of Jews moved into Jewish neighborhoods, but were they facing anti-Semitism if they didn't? Were there feelings like, here are all of these Jewish immigrants and they're kind of going to take our jobs, the sort of thing that we're hearing now about other immigrants?
That's a really common phenomenon for every group of displaced persons, Jews or non-Jews. In fact, there's a really incredible short story by Flannery O'Connor called The Displaced Person, and it's exactly about this community that sort of encounters this non-Jewish displaced person who's a really hard worker, and they're incredibly resentful of it. So I don't know that it was that the anti-Semitism was linked to the sort of jobs issue as much as immigrants generally create a lot of job anxiety for people.
And then when immigrants come to a new place, there's always the assimilation issue. Some choose to become as much like the people they have joined, and others want to hold on to the things they had in the old country?
Well, that's a lot of the, I don't know, conflict exactly, but sort of the ambivalence that a lot of the characters in the book feel, not just about assimilating to the United States versus not, because for them, they want to get rid of Europe. They do not want to go back there. They don't really have nostalgia because there's nothing left there to be nostalgic about. But there is a lot of concern among the characters that this sort of new world that has a lot of opportunity and is much more free for them is also a world where their kids are going to not know anything about what happened to them, not know anything about their religion, not know anything about their culture. So there's a lot of anxiety about that, even though the characters in this book really want to be Americans.
Now, often when people write a book of this sort, inspired to some degree by what happened to their parents, we see it in those terms. But you're a civil rights lawyer who specializes in immigrants' rights litigation. Is that what got you thinking about writing this kind of book now?
Before I had this job, I had sort of lots of different jobs in poverty law and in immigration law before I did civil rights work. And I sort of always thought about those issues kind of together. So I don't know if my job inspired the book or the book and the job are somehow related. But yeah, it's immigrants' rights are something that I think about a lot. And my work is actually a really nice counterpoint to working on the book, which, you know, for the most part doesn't take place in the present. You know, the last year in the book is the year 2000. And so it's nice to sort of have both sides, the historical and the present tense.
Your parents were Jewish refugees who wound up in New York City?
That's right. They met here.
Were they both Holocaust survivors?
Both of them were born in Poland. My father survived concentration camps. My mother, like some of the characters in this book, fled when she was a very, very small child to the Soviet Union and survived in Siberia and Kazakhstan and places like that. So that's what their history is. One of the things that I felt very committed to when doing the book was to sort of avoid a kind of hierarchy of, you know, if you were in a camp, you're a real survivor, and if you were hiding in a haystack somewhere, you weren't. So my answer is always to sort of give those facts. But they met here. They were both actually in near that same camp that's discussed in the book, but they didn't know each other there.
Well, many of the people who thought they were escaping to the Soviet Union didn't know what they were escaping to. They had a lot of troubles there.
It was incredibly. My mother had a very deprived childhood. I mean, she didn't, like one of the characters in the book, she didn't really go to school until she got to the displaced persons camp. There's sort of two sides to that coin, which is that a lot of the Jews who fled Poland for the Soviet Union did survive. They had a much higher survival rate, but it was still, you know, an extremely painful, desperate place to be.
Did your parents move to a Jewish neighborhood in New York?
Originally, my father sort of lived in lots of different officially Jewish neighborhoods. You know, he lived in Jackson Heights. He lived in Ridgewood for a short time. And then they both moved to the Upper West Side.
Your story moves through three distinct time periods, the late 1940s, 1960 to 1973, and then finally to the 1990s. Do you think the Holocaust came to mean different things in each of these decades?
Yes. I mean, this idea that, you know, people came out of the camps or came out of hiding and realized that they had survived this massive historical tragedy, you know, I don't think people conceived of it like that. And sort of the depth of and breadth of what had happened to their communities wasn't really obvious at that time. And when people first came to the United States from the displaced persons camps and from Europe, there really wasn't this atmosphere that we now take for granted that, you know, you talk about your experiences and you give an oral history and you do all those things that communicate what happened to you to the world. That's really a very, very recent phenomenon.
And then it became part of the popular culture. And we had television miniseries and we had Schindler's List, which figures in your book, the family, the two parents, Chaim and Sima, and their daughter Lola, disagree about Steven Spielberg's movie. Lola is the one who likes it least.
That's right. Well, one thing I did want to do is have I wanted to show some intergenerational conflict or conversations, not always conflict. But one thing I did want to do was show people discussing how the Holocaust is represented among their families, because people do it all the time. And in that same chapter, they're also having a sort of passive-aggressive fight about Israeli politics and things that, you know, every family, I think, has. You know, you come home from college and Uncle Irving and, you know, Jonathan get into a big discussion about Israel, and then everyone sort of panics, and then, you know, you move on to the brisket or whatever. But I really wanted to show that part of Jewish culture, which is debate, and there isn't always political agreement, and not everybody sees things the same way.
And in this case, Lola feels that Schindler's List spends too much time on the righteous goy rather than on the people who he was saving.
That's exactly right. She feels that it's Hollywoodized, that it makes a hero out of someone who did an incredible thing and saved many lives, but also that it sort of erases the stories of the people who were in the Krakow ghetto at that time.
Some people have argued that the Holocaust has become a commodity for some people.
Some people argue that in the book, too. There's a lot of discomfort among the survivors, and in some cases their kids, about sort of taking advantage of this popular fondness for the Holocaust or for, you know, this traumatic experience. And that's something that the actual characters in the book feel very concerned about, and, you know, they're very conflicted about it. On the one hand, they're very, very happy that Steven Spielberg has made a movie about an experience similar to theirs. On the other hand, you know, they do feel what many people feel, which is it's sort of erasing the experience in a way to sort of make it something that people buy.
Gita Schwartz will be giving a reading and signing books on Monday at the Greenlight Bookstore at 7:30. That's at 686 Fulton Street in Brooklyn. Her book, Displaced Persons, is published by William Morrow. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.